Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Folklore. My name is Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today we'll be talking with Ian Brody about his book, A Vulgar Art, A New Approach to Stand-Up Comedy. Ian Brody is Associate Professor of Folklore at Cape Breton University. How are you, Ian?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Folklore. My name is Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today we'll be talking with Ian Brody about his book, A Vulgar Art, A New Approach to Stand-Up Comedy. Ian Brody is Associate Professor of Folklore at Cape Breton University. How are you, Ian?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
I'm doing well, thank you. I wonder if you would begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I'm Canadian. I was born in Ottawa, which is, depending on how international your audience is, the nation's capital. So I have lots of scorn heaped upon me. You're from Washington, are you not?
Columbus, D.C., actually. Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, Columbus, Ohio. I'm sorry. I thought you were, you spent some time in Washington, so you know what it's like to sort of be the center of power and the nasty looks that your friends might ever so often give to you. I did undergraduate and master's degrees in religious studies. And then when I was at Memorial completing my MA there, I discovered the folklore department. My wife was also a student there, and she discovered folklore probably before me. She's a much better folklorist in many ways, Jody McDavid. And, I just fell into it. My master's research had been in, as I said, religious studies, but more, methods of religion, methods of theology, actually. I was using the work of Bernard Lonergan, and he had an idea of how disciplines relate to each other. I mean, his big work from 1972 is a book called Method in Theology, and explains functional specialization in theology. And I was trying to extrapolate that onto a religious studies model as well. But what I found most interesting and what folklore intrigued me was that one of Lonergan's other approaches is the idea that we operate in many ways in the realm of theory when we are being theorists, and but we also in our day to day we operate in the realm of common sense, i.e. the things that are familiar to our group that we don't go into explanation for because we know them. To actually bring attention to them is to it would be peculiar, sort of not as good as a wink. And when I was sort of peeking over my wife's shoulder and finding out what she was studying in folklore, I was intrigued by this discipline that was in many ways the study of common sense. Folklorists might balk at the idea of common sense, but I'm meaning that in that very technical way, i.e. the things that are particular to a group. So that's how I sort of wrapped my head around what folklore was, and that's how I started studying it.
Great. And I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about how you came to write A Vulgar Art.
Well, it was the very initial idea was in my folk literature courses when I was coming across these genres of talk that I hadn't necessarily encountered before. And one of them particularly was the African-American roast, the sort of the long form scatological poem. And I'm now, of course, blanking on the precise name. Stagger Lee is one of the great examples of that. So, violent, sexual, earthy poems. And I realized that, hey, I had just bought at a Blockbuster bargain bin a copy of Rudy Ray Moore's Live VHS, because I was always interested in stand up, and it was just something that I collected as a fan. And I said, that is a genre that I didn't know about. And I saw Rudy Ray Moore, who did his Dolemite character. And they were these monologues that were African-American, violent, sexual verse. And so I was making that sort of early folklore connection, where I'm basically thinking of the kind of things that people do on stage, and that here is a genre, and now let's see how it's done on stage. And it's easy to do that sort of motif spotting or that genre spotting. But as my folklore studies progressed, I realized it isn't simply a matter of identifying jokes or identifying tales or even identifying entire genres. It's looking at these as forms of performance and about relations. So, but that was my initial entrance into it. So I was trying to figure out what exactly a stand-up comedian is doing when they are on a stage, and how that is both related to and then distinct from the kind of performative talk that we do in small context situations in our among intimates, among family, among peers.
Oh, that's great. Not to jump the gun too much, but what did you find out?
Well, basically, when we start looking at things like two influential works might be a way of starting this off. And one of them was Richard Bauman's work on the Lehave Islanders and the kind of talk that occurs in at the store in the winter. And that's the main form of entertainment, is the men would go on the winter's evenings and just talk at the store. And that was basically a form of verbal play. And then building on that, there was Michael J. Bell's work on what's it called? The Worlds from Brown's Lounge, which is about the African-American middle-class bar in Philadelphia, where he did his field work. And he also posited that place as a site of what we would now call a third space, but a site of middle-class play that is not home, it's not work, and the form of play is talk. And it's conversation, out of which often emerges someone who takes the stage, as it were, or at least attention is drawn towards him. And in this situation, it's often exclusively him. But attention is drawn towards him, and he engages in a very performative form of speech, and then sort of merges back into the crowd, as it were. And that was sort of a trigger for me in terms of the relationship to stand-up, in that if we stop thinking of stand-up as an enumeration of genres, or even an enumeration of topics, and think of it as basically the kind of talk that emerges in play situations where one person has momentarily taken drawn focus towards him or herself, and the audience becomes audience, or rather the rest of the people assume the character of audience, allow that form of talk to occur, and that talk needs to meet local expectations of fluency and relevance and aesthetics. That is kind of what's happening with stand-up. But, of course, stand-up is a profession, and so how do you build that model into a situation where you're no longer dealing with your friends, your intimates, your neighbors, but strangers?
Yeah, and I think I really love how the book is structured, sort of almost like a comedy performance itself. It sort of opens... it's got front matter entitled Let's Go Out and Welcome to the Show. And then the three major parts are the opener, the middle, and the headliner.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is, like, again, like if you've ever been to a stand-up show, there's often like the first person on. They're good, they're trying, but they're not necessarily going to be everyone's cup of tea because they're in this initial situation. So they're often the person that's most overlooked. Fundamentally, that's where I wanted to put like the literature chapter, the stuff that would be of more interest to the academic folklorist, and, you know, locating it within a specific argument. I think it's I think it's strong and I think it's necessary, but I know a lot of readers would probably be much more interested in the slightly showier stuff where I'm not talking around stand-up. I'm actually talking about stand-up, as it were. So let's say, if you really need to, you can skip this part and these are the things you're going to find most intriguing. And then the middle is sort of, in many ways, the more up and coming, has a better grasp of the material and is probably the person who, in retrospect, you might not necessarily be going to the show for that person, but later on you might say, hey, that person was pretty good, and see them on a stage or see them on television a couple of months later and say, oh, I was at that guy's show. He was really great. And then the final is the headliner, the one that you are going to the person you probably went there for. And that was really kind of that third section, which is almost a sort of history of stand-up in terms of its various forms of mediation. So, you give book structures because structure is a good thing. So I wanted to provide some kind of more or less tacit guide on how to go through it.
I think it's excellent. Let's start with the opener, even though it's the part you suggest might be easiest to overlook if one is not in the discipline. But since this is New Books in Folklore, tell us a little bit about sort of the disciplinary work that you feel like you do in that chapter.
Well, one of the things that I'm trying to establish, and this is in many ways sort of doubling down on the points that I was raising before, is that it's very it's probably a first idea is to try and make that one-to-one correlation between genres and what what a stand-up comedian tells, because we like simplicity in many ways. But I wanted to bring two facets into it. One was this discussion of thinking of it as a kind of talk between people, the kind of talk that is basically about building, establishing, or reestablishing a sense of community, a sense of consensus without necessarily imposing homogeneity on the community, but the kind of small talk that we engage in all the time, using terms like shit talk or bullshit. It's playful, but it has a meaning behind it in that it is intentionally sort of non-hierarchical. And in those forms of talk, Brown's Lounge in Philadelphia, or in the store on the Lehave Islands, or in any of these situations, and we all experience them in our lives, out of that comes specific marked performance, or at least markable performances. So it's not that stand-ups don't tell jokes, or it's not that they're not engaged in some kind of genres, but it's more important to think of the entire event as serving some kind of communicative function, establishing rapport and building community. And then out of that kind of talk, certain genres will emerge. So that's sort of the first thrust of the discussion, breaking down the stand-ups tell jokes dichotomy. The second is drawing on work that Peter Narvaez and Martin Laba had developed in what they call the folklore popular culture continuum, and very much the work of Neil Rosenberg, who contributed to that volume, but had done much work on his own in terms of the relationship between the amateur and the professional. Because I think one of the things that's important to remember is that stand-up is a profession, and that once you enter into an economic model, once you enter into the idea that your kinds of fluency and competency at performance are expected to meet a certain standard, that changes the equation somehow. It's all of a sudden there's just a different set of expectations. Those the kind of things that you are that an audience would be looking for would be similar. It's just the ability to do so has a higher bar. You're not, once you're paying someone, you expect results, basically. And so in Neil's argument for what distinguishes the amateur and the professional, it is not necessarily ability. It is about an understanding of audience. In his work, he talks about that once you are engaged in this model, in an economic model, one of the things that you need to do is get a better and better appreciation of your audience's expectations, develop and cultivate a reputation for fluency and competence to the point where you can actually come into a place and be known already for being competent at performance. Because in addition to wanting to establish a reputation, you want that reputation to precede you, and you want that reputation to precede you in larger and larger markets. So as you move from local to regional to national to international models, it is about, I don't want to say transcend because it makes it sound like it's being better than, but rather it's about moving away from your local expectations and having a better and better grasp of the expectations of another place, whether that is thinking of large collections, like looking at sort of like an international market, or getting a sense of all the different local expectations and being able to immediately address those. So it really shifts the focus on how much a stand-up comedy is about understanding audience. It doesn't mean that you are merely catering to tastes. It is about, both meeting expectations, but also bringing novelty, bringing an idiosyncratic style and to an audience that already has a set of expectations, if not of your performance, then about what a stand-up performance means. So that is a slightly cumbersome way of talking about that first chapter, but it's a way of sort of breaking that genre categorization model, and it is about really emphasizing the profession as having to do with grasping the audience's expectations and grasping different audiences' expectations.
So is it then kind of a question of scale?
It can be a question of scale. Yeah. Because it's sort of what happens when, let me put it this way. When you are speaking to a group of friends, and you are engaged in the kind of talk that you might engage in at a convention, or an academic conference backstage, or when you are at the bar after work, or any of these scenes that we do engage in, you kind of have a shared repertoire, a shared worldview, a shared set of expectations. You obviously bring your own experiences to it, but you don't necessarily need to spell out those references that you understand is shared. Once you get beyond your immediate circle of friends, you can't necessarily expect everyone to understand what you are saying. So you need to do one of two things. You need to either learn their sets of expectations, or you need to figure out and worldview and common references, or you need to speak to larger and larger topics that we tend to participate in, not simply on the local level, but as parts of a regional or a national dialogue. So hence popular culture is as likely to be a topic, politics, global politics is likely to be a topic, and so on. So it's about, moving away from the locally, circumscribed in order to, as you say, engage in market scale. Now, you always do want to appeal to the local, and one of the things that happens in the stand-up circuit, and if you've ever seen a stand-up show, you probably recognize this, and someone will come to town, and they'll begin their routine, usually with some kind of local reference, having maybe only spent the time from the airport to the downtown or to the venue, but something that they can grasp as local to kind of orient themselves before they go into their standard routines. And their standard routines are typically on a national or international reference points.
Okay. So after the opener, we get to the section entitled The Middle, in which you talk about the who, what, and where of stand-up comedy in live performance. And I'm wondering if, and specifically you're really getting into the live performance itself, right? And as well as the profession of who is the comedian, who is, I think your subtitles are, who is the comedian and who is this comedian? And so I'm wondering if you could talk about this a little bit more, and about these issues a little bit more.
Well, that whole section in the middle is called Creating Intimacy Over Distance. And one of the, quickly going back to those first principles, the idea is that stand-ups are engaged in the kind of talk that appears towards intimates, that happens among intimates, I should say, but is at the same time now being done to people or with people that you are strange to. You are a stranger. There's a socio-cultural distance between you. And when we get into the sections of mediation, there's a also often a temporal distance and a physical distance between the audience, between the performer and members of the audience. So it is about, if one of the things that one is trying to do is cultivate an audience and fundamentally orient an audience into being primed to understand your text, one of the things that you are trying to do is create that sense of intimacy, create a sense that the person in the crowd kind of knows who you are, can correlate your experience with theirs somehow, and enter into that non-hierarchical friendly talk, the kind of friendly talk that kind of allows for certain forms of license. When you are among friends, you can kind of, and he says this very cautiously, you can kind of get away with material that is risque, maybe engaging in on the borders of appropriate, in part because there's that sort of shock value, and in part it's because you're trying to establish, and if you know someone who is like this, you already know that the person is fundamentally coming from a good place and that this is a kind of play that is happening. When you're dealing with a stranger, someone else on stage that you don't know, that you don't necessarily assume is coming from a good place, you kind of have to introduce that as an idea. Now you have the benefit of the apparatus of stand-up itself. You have the fact that someone has brought you up on stage. You have the MC who introduces you and orients the crowd in a certain way through a fairly pat biography. You even have such things about like what you are wearing. I mean, even before what you are wearing, there's biology. If you are an African American comedian, that signals something because we live in a society that categorizes in that way. That categorization needs to be addressed, and the performance proceeds from there. If you're a person of size, if you are a little person, if you are transgender, or if you are differently gendered, there are other expectations that that typically the audience addresses, gets addressed to the audience, and then it moves on to that different level of different kind of conversation where, okay, this person is someone that I can listen to. So you have the MC, you have what people are, how people look, you have what people are wearing, what does a suit signal as opposed to something like shorts and t-shirt? What are the cues that the stand-up comedian is providing in order to orient the talk that is about to ensue? And so, even before the stand-up opens his or her mouth, there's already some kind of signal about how the text is going to be interpreted. Then you might have an opening statement, as I said, whether you're the local first timer or whether you are an established act, it is about text that establishes rapport, some kind of specific example of common experience. And it's that specific example of common experience that might transcend the categorical difference that might be occasioned by skin color or gender or any of these categories. And then talk can ensue from then. And talk can move to general pools of references once the local pool has exhausted itself. I went up to Halifax a few months ago and saw Jim Gaffigan, for example, a internationally established comedian that many Netflix specials and so on. And he was in the the local hockey arena, one of the, probably the largest indoor venue in all of Nova Scotia. And he began, you know, Jim Gaffigan is a comedian about food. He had the benefit that most people were there to see Jim Gaffigan, not simply to see a comedy show. So he had the benefit of celebrity. He had the weight of his established reputation. And yet, nonetheless, he began with a few minutes on the Donair, which is the local Nova Scotia street food, which is, like most street foods, a blend of both delightful and disgusting. And he was able to orient himself within the local food stuff. So it works in terms of his reputation. It works in terms of what Haligonians, the collective term for people from Halifax, think of that food stuff already. And then he could go into his more or less standard routine and only make, you know, passing references to the Halifax context later on. He didn't need that anymore. He could sort of, he has aligned himself. He's orientated himself with the crowd, and they can just move on. In addition to the already extant goodwill people had towards him because of his reputation.
So this is, there's one part where you use the term the intimate other. And I guess this is kind of what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. In that you are recognizing that despite the sociocultural distance, there is fundamentally, you are now speaking to this person as if we were all on the same social plane. And I mean, then we can start to turn to things like the actual sort of verbal techniques. What is not simply the topics, but one of the themes of the stand-up is not simply the intimate other, but some kind of perhaps social commentator, social critic, social anthropologist, a lot of various forms that are sometimes applied to the stand-up. But fundamentally, one of the key ones is that they are somehow outside of the corridors of power in the same way that an audience is outside the corridors of power. There's always some suggestion that there is something counter-hegemonic going on, an appeal to an external and shared oppressor, for lack of a better word. Now, that might be very much a conceit. It's very difficult to see someone who is so very coterminous with, you know, the white, cisgender, heterosexual power structures to somehow sort of give this impression that they are somehow oppressed. And that's why sometimes the comedy falls. But that's also sometimes why their oppression is in terms of sort of the generic stupidity of the world. It's not necessarily the power structures, but we all understand that, you know, why do we have these mattress tags? Isn't that silly? Who is doing this to us? It's like, you're right. We do all understand that. So we find that common cause. You know, hopefully a successful performance will find common cause. Doesn't necessarily mean that everyone in the crowd will do so. Doesn't mean that every time the performer does that, he or she is going to succeed in finding that common cause. But that is one of the techniques, building a sort of a safe space that often pillories some kind of outside power. So I might be Canadian, you might be African American, but we both have this sort of sense of outsiderdom, and let's bind this outsiderdom. I need to make a fairly strong rhetorical case in order to allow that conceit to continue. And it is, it's recognized as play. It doesn't necessarily mean that anyone will leave the performance thinking that this person is fundamentally oppressed, but it is a performance of being othered somehow. It's a performance of not being present to the realms of power. You even see that in terms of, you know, conservative comedy, where they are very coterminous with the corridors of power, but they still sort of find some kind of other. And I think that's one of the points to make, is that we are often finding some kind of noble purpose to stand up, and that it's inherently, you know, it's inherently progressive, or it's inherently a powerful way of speaking truth to power, but nevertheless, it's also a performance of that speaking truth to power. And so you can see traditions of comedy that are just as oppressive. They are successful because the audience has, or because the comedian has found an audience that they can find common cause with, even if we on outside of that group do not appreciate that common cause and find it actually regressive or destructive somehow. One of the things that is being played with is the rebellious nature of stand up to begin with. But what happens when that rebellion is actually fundamentally serving to entrench regressive attitudes? That's a difficult area to get into.
Right. Okay. And one of the things that you also bring up is you sort of talk about some of these techniques, whether it's social commentator or what else. One of the terms that I really latched onto when reading the book was this term vernacular ethnography, sort of the way that this is sort of its own sort of informal process of conducting ethnography where people sort of are able to look at and evaluate human behavior. And that might be part of an audience's generic expectations of the comedian. Yeah.
Yeah. The idea of being this outsider and looking at a place and describing it. I go back to the, it didn't originate with Geertz, but I think Geertz made it so very popular. The idea that ethnography or the role of the ethnographer is to make the strange familiar and the familiar strange. And I think that definitely is part of the stand-up, the stand-up body of techniques, because you certainly have taking someone's idiosyncratic experience, a life story that is, you know, strange to the audience, or at least, you know, unfamiliar, and communicating it in a way that makes it relevant and you know, funny as well. I mean, funny is always the goal, but one of the techniques of funny is to make it relevant and recognizable, and that we see the foibles that are the cause of this particular instance of humor. Similarly, we have observational comedy, which is the things that we are already familiar with, that we live with, going back to the aforementioned mattress tags, and drawing attention to them to the point where we all go, oh yeah, why do we do that? And so that's the making the familiar strange. But I mean, I take the term ethnography reasonably seriously in terms of, you know, how an academic might use ethnography. But at the same time, if it is about trying to depict a culture or trying to depict a cultural moment to an audience in order to make a point, whether that audience is a literary and academic audience in terms of the sort of more formal structures of ethnography, or whether that is on the casual level of me simply communicating my experience to someone else, that is fundamentally what the stand-up is doing. It doesn't have that bent of necessarily creating a text that is subsequently subject to some kind of deep analysis. It's there to be a benchmark for instances of humor. When I teach my fieldwork classes, for example, I use the in trying to explain what ethnography is, I use an expression that Gua Shaker told me once. He's at the Smithsonian Library of Congress. I can't quite remember. Library of Congress, yes. And he described ethnography as deep hanging out. And so once I sort of had that key to it, I explained to my students that, you know, when you are doing ethnography, you are doing what you do anyway. You all have experience of going to a place, figuring out what it is to work in that place, and subsequently often telling someone about that place. The deep part is really doing it with this purpose of creating a text for subsequent analysis and to a third party who is completely absent from it. That is one of the ways that I approach stand-up as well, this vernacular ethnography. It is to describe and not simply describe, but evoke a place, a time, an event, but not for the purpose of analysis, for the purpose of humor.
Right. And okay, that's one of the things that I also noticed, though, is that I think you suggest that it can't just be reportage, though. Yeah, it needs to. I think the key word that you use is you mentioned verisimilitude. And it seems extremely important in my mind to your analysis and of the comedian's art. Why is verisimilitude so important, and what do you mean by it?
Well, I think it needs to fundamentally ring true, even within the performative aspect of stand-up, which allows a certain license. It allows for descriptions to be remarkably florid. It allows for similes or metaphors to be perhaps a little bit much. At the same time, an experience is often something, the experience being related has to somehow seem on one basic level plausible. I'm again reminded of Bauman's work in the Lehave Islands, where he talks about yarns as one of the forms of talk that happen. And yarns are personal experience narratives that are going to be that relate to experiences that were had typically outside of that community, or and were had when they were away from that community. And they can be fanciful. There's a certain aesthetics to them. There's a certain creativity that's allowed them, but they still have to be understood as true accounts, because the account needs to be understood as fundamentally relevant to the audience. So the verisimilitude is that this can't just be merely fanciful, even at those times when the sort of verisimilitude frame is broken and we have some kind of obviously fantastic element introduced, that is sort of grasped as much more of a flourish than anything else. I'm thinking of, there's some Richard Pryor routines where he describes his neighbor's dog, who is always chasing him and barking at him because he lives in a predominantly white neighborhood, and of course he's African American, and lo and behold, one day he's out in the backyard and he's very sad because Richard Pryor had a pet monkey and the pet monkey died, and so he's obviously sad, and the dog runs up to him and starts barking and then stops and says, "Hey Richard, why are you crying?" And so obviously we've entered into a different level of description at this point, and he sort of consoles him, you know, genuinely feels bad for his loss, and then says, "Well, tomorrow I'm still going to be trying to kill you." It's like, "Oh, okay, that's fine," and the story ends. But we have that entry into what is clearly fantastic still has a point in this overall discussion about what it is to be both an affluent African American, but an African American nonetheless. So verisimilitude, I think, is one of the expectations that we have towards the stand-up, because it isn't simply a matter of joke telling. And certainly one of the things that we try and do when we are establishing some kind of functional and profound importance to stand up, what we'll often come across in the academic literature is people who identify certain stand ups as sort of true or, genuinely important ones, and almost everyone else is superfluous or some kind of lesser than. And one of the things that we point to is the fact that, well, they are saying something very important. And so it's almost that it needs to be, it almost needs to be listened to as some important tract and important social commentary. And so, if you're going to be basing something in, if you're going to be making those kind of rhetorical arguments, it is important that you're dealing with, for lack of better words, actual data, as opposed to something that is clearly and self-referentially more fictive, more fantastic. So that is, I think, when we start to try and rationalize stand-up as a performance genre. And when we, and when I say we, I mean sort of the culture as a whole trying to recognize or trying to rationalize stand-up's appeal. And almost invariably, we start trying to make arguments for its profundity, as opposed to the occasional moments of profundity being one of the many possible techniques that certain stand-ups might choose to frame their kinds of performance. But a stand-up performance isn't good because it's profound. A stand-up performance is good because the audience that performance is being geared towards finds it hilarious. If it could be a series of dumb jokes that you and I might not like, you and I not appreciate just because they're dumb, let alone because we might think of them as regressive or whatever. But if the audience laughs, it's a successful performance. The culture might need to change, but the stand-up has proven that they have an understanding of their audience.
Right. And so finally, in part three, the section you entitled The Headliner, you talk about stand-up comedians sort of as the mediatization of comedy. And so as it goes into broadcast and recordings, and how this in particular sort of takes them out of the communication in small groups around which so much folklore studies is focused. How does that work in the case of the comedians? You've kind of discussed this already, but.
Well, I'll say it does and it doesn't. It does because we're now dealing with a different kind of, a specific relationship between the performer and part of their audience. But what we still have, and what makes stand-up so very intriguing, is that we also have a live audience present to it. Stand-up, I don't think I can think of any examples of stand-up that are performed without an audience in front. There might be some ill-advised examples from the early days of trying to record it where they were using something more like a laugh track, but those would certainly be the exception. Every mediation of stand-up requires a live audience. And because every mediation of stand-up requires a live audience, you have two audiences present. You have that small group now on a stage, now, you know, larger than the group of intimates, but still a live performance that live in a specific historical moment and live in a specific geographic place. And the stand-up needs to appeal to that audience as well as the undifferentiated audience that is, for lack of better words, at home, at the other end of whatever this recording medium is, or the other end of this medium is, whether we're talking radio, whether we are talking live television broadcast, or when we start talking about tangible recordings. And I distinguish those because with radio, with live radio and live recording, you still have that temporal contiguity. I mean, if you go something that's recorded live or virtually as live and goes out that week, you're dealing with the same basic time era. You're talking about events of the day. If your recording is something that is meant to sort of transcend that moment, you are going to shift your material so that it is not as temporally laden. So what does it mean to listen to a recording that was made in the late 1960s? And the ones that seem to have a certain amount of staying power are the ones that are not necessarily mired in the specifics of 1960s references. I can still understand what they are talking about, and the references are more or less still ongoingly relevant. But what the recording has, this very fascinating aspect where we still have the live audience captured on it. So we always have their laughter to go by. And then that brings it back to the idea that stand-up is a communal event, that stand-up is something that is not simply a one-to-one experience, but it is a person speaking to a crowd. And so the person who is listening at home is fundamentally also participating in that crowd moment. Which brings the interesting idea of why we can listen to a stand-up recording more than once. Well, we are always present to an audience who is listening to it for the first time. So this third part is really about the techniques of how this spatio-temporal distance is negotiated. We already have the sociocultural distance in terms of someone going from their home community to further afield, but they're still dealing with a live audience and they can make it ongoingly relevant. Once you have the undifferentiated audience of the other end of a medium, you have a different kind of manipulation of the text to keep it ongoingly relevant, with the proviso that you still also need to address the fact that there are people in the room with you.
It makes me think of Richard Bauman's thoughts about remediation of storytelling in early sound recordings. Was that something that you sort of looked at in this section? I don't quite recall.
No, I wasn't using him at this point. It was as much a study of Narvaez and Rosenberg and those people. So I was very influenced by music as well. One of the other points that is, I think, important about the idea of being on the stage is the self-evident idea that they're using a microphone, that there's a public address system. And I, on a historical level, one of the ways I trace stand-up back to an event is the fact that you now have the ability to speak in a normal tone of voice to a crowd that is larger than you could if you didn't have a public address system. So you're able to, historically, people like to trace stand-up to the age of vaudeville and so on. But that was someone on a stage basically having to yell over a crowd. And once you're yelling, you don't necessarily have the ability to go into subtle digressions and descriptions. When you can speak in an intimate tone of voice, your tone is something that can be, and you have control. You have the benefit of amplification that you can always essentially, if need be, talk down an audience. You have the ability to go on long digressions, and you can speak in a more intimate form. So intimate in the sense of it's almost like you're being spoken to across a table, whether, despite the fact that it might be across a theater or across an arena. So the crooners and the study of crooning was something that was interesting to me, where, what differentiated Bing Crosby and Billie Holiday from the predecessors was understanding of the microphone and being able to perform in a way that more emulated a natural speaking, singing register. And this is about speech. So the same basic premise there.
Wonderful. Well, Ian, we've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you so much. I'll just ask you one more question, and that's, what are you working on now?
Well, one of the things I'm working on is a local to Cape Breton, which is where I'm based, a local radio contest from the 1950s, where things were being songs were solicited that were parodies of songs of the day on a Cape Breton theme. And it ties into some other recent work I've been doing in terms of local Cape Breton comic book from the 1970s. And it's related to the stand-up because it has to do with what happens when you are participating in a very small local popular culture where you are going to be reaching a group larger than your immediate group of peers and friends in that common reference, but you're not necessarily speaking to a national or even a particularly regional audience. It is how do you make something that is ongoingly relevant for this, for the comic book? It was a local illustrator, Paul McKinnon, who did books for his friends and had all these in-jokes in them. And then he wanted to turn it into something professional. And so he needed to reevaluate his material and create something that a Cape Bretoner, only perhaps a Cape Bretoner, would understand. But you didn't have to know him to understand it. Similarly to these local songmakers who are basically home listeners for a daytime show in the 1950s, almost exclusively women, they were writing songs that were expressly about local concerns that might be completely esoteric to someone who is not from here. And one of the benefits I have is that since I am not from here, I come to this material and I say, I know it's funny. I know that there's jokes here. I don't get them. And so I'm parsing my way through. So that's the Dishpan Parade was the name of the radio show and their Cape Breton Songs Contest. So that's what I've been working on for the past year or so.
Oh, that sounds great. Sounds like a really fantastic project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Timothy.